Exodus chapter 6. We're continuing our series through the book of Exodus. This is message number 8 in that series. The title of this message is Strong Medicine. We'll be looking at Exodus chapter 6 in this message, and I want to read verse 1 to get us started. Then the Lord said unto Moses, Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of his land. Well, chapter 5 recounts the first audience that Moses and Aaron had with Pharaoh to deliver the word of the Lord to him. And what began so hopefully at the beginning of that chapter seemed to quickly evaporate as Pharaoh brought a hard reality in the form of increased burden and suffering to the slaves of Israel. And it hit hard as they suffered under his new rules, and essentially the people were exhausted with an impossible task. The foremen were beaten because the people couldn't accomplish it, and Moses and Aaron were blamed, and Moses even despaired of the whole enterprise before God. But the effect of chapter 5 is understood when we read back particularly to chapters 3 and 4, and remember that God clearly revealed beforehand to Moses what would happen. He didn't reveal every little detail of it, but he clearly told him that he would harden Pharaoh's heart and Pharaoh would not let the people go. So chapter 5 highlighted the fact that God works everything according to his own will. He works everything according to his own purpose, and the actions and the reactions of men do not prevent, hinder, or alter his purpose. So as we come to chapter 6, this is an important chapter that bridges between chapter 5 and chapter 7. Moses and Aaron go back to Pharaoh in chapter 7, but here in chapter 6, after we've seen some of the fallout from their first meeting, we see God's reaction, and I would probably put that word in some quotes. It's not a reaction. It is the action of God. All of his works are known to God beforehand. And so throughout this chapter and Moses' conversation with God, we learn another crucial lesson. God is unaffected and nothing has changed his plans. In the eyes of Moses and perhaps even Aaron and maybe with Israel, this is all just falling apart. You know, this was a good idea. It was great while it lasted, but this didn't work, and it only made things worse. So let's just abandon this. But God wasn't surprised by any of that. Again, he clearly told Moses what was going to happen, and so God is not provoked here to some sort of a quick and thoughtless action like many of the humans involved, and what even happens to us many times. We may be having just a fine day, and something happens, and just a quick, thoughtless action makes things quite worse. Well, Moses learns that God is doing what he's doing, and he's doing it the way that he's doing it, in order that he might make himself known. And that really is the great purpose of this book. To make God known. It comes up over and over and over again in this book. And that should make us maybe question or consider how important that this book is to us. In other words, if this is a book of God making himself known, and it surely is because it tells us that repeatedly, then how much do we study this book? How much do we pay attention to the book of Exodus? How much do we think about it, or do we neglect it? We want to look at this chapter in two parts. In verses 1 to 13, the Lord speaks. And so chapter 5 gave us Pharaoh speaking, Moses and Aaron speaking, Israel speaking, and chapter 6 begins with the Lord speaking in verses 1 to 13. And in verses 14 to 30, before Moses and Aaron are going to go back to Pharaoh, it is reinforced and emphasized that he is still God. So we'll start with the first part. Verse number 1 again. Then the Lord said unto Moses, Now shalt thou see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand shall he let them go, and with a strong hand shall he drive them out of the land. Well, Pharaoh's stance, of course, toward Moses and Aaron, and then later to those foremen of Israel, was as firm as it could be. He would not let the people go. He's not going to consider that any further. Of course, that only sets the stage just as God had planned. And so now God speaks to Moses. Remember, Moses was in despair at the end of chapter 5, and he's questioned the Lord, and now the Lord is responding. And he speaks to Moses, and he tells Moses that now you're going to see what God will do. Of course, this is according to what God had already revealed to Moses back at the burning bush. So chapter 3, verses 19 and 20. And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, not by a mighty hand. And I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. So God had already revealed to Moses that Pharaoh is not going to let you go. And it's only going to be after that God stretches out his hand and strikes and afflicts and brings destruction to Egypt that he's going to let the people go. So Pharaoh will change his mind, and that's what we see there toward the end of that verse. He will let them go. In fact, he's going to send them away because of what is going to happen. And this is just a reminder that despite everything that's happened to this point, God is unchanged. God's plan is unchanged. He's not doing anything differently as we begin chapter 6 than what he was when we started the whole entire book. God is unchanged. Let's look at verses 2 to 4. And God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am the Lord. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah was I not known to them. And I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage, wherein they were strangers. So God essentially begins by reiterating to Moses that he is Yahweh, the I am, the eternal self-existent one. There is one throne over this universe, and only God sits there. And he just reiterates to Moses that I am who I am, just as he revealed at the burning bush in Sinai. And he reiterates his purpose with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and how that he appeared to them, which explains why they were there, why God had come down. In other words, why is Moses and the Lord even having this conversation? Why is Moses in Egypt? Why did Moses go see Pharaoh to begin with? Well, it's because of God's promise to the patriarchs. And remember that he gave Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he gave them his name as surety for his covenant promises. And as far as this, he was known of the name of God Almighty, El Shaddai, was not known by his name, Jehovah or Yahweh. I was not known to them. He gave his name as surety for this covenant, but he did not make himself known to them in the way that he is and will in Egypt and here in the book of Exodus. He's making himself known in an even greater way than what he did to the patriarchs. But nevertheless, what he's doing is because of what he gave his name in promise to swear an oath, beginning with Abraham back there in Genesis. So God made a covenant promise that is secured by his own name. What does that mean? That means that he cannot break it. It's not possible. He will and must keep it. Now, the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they will inherit the land of Canaan as it was previously described to Abraham as an everlasting possession. So God is reaffirming to Moses that, look, this is a sure promise. This is secured by my very name. And I didn't even reveal as much of my name to them as I am to you and plan to. This is a sure promise. This will come about. And of course, we know Moses, he does learn this lesson, as we will see later in the book of Exodus, but not here in this chapter today. Look at verses 5 to 8. And I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. And I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments, and I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and ye shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you unto the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for an heritage. I am the Lord. So he starts here by reminding Moses that he has heard the cries of those of Israel in the bondage in Egypt, and he has remembered his covenant. And we've encountered this language a number of times, especially in our study of the Psalms, and we've encountered it here already. This language of remembering, it's not that he did forget or he temporarily forgot or even that he could possibly forget, but it is a sort of covenantal language that God is acknowledging that he has sworn an oath, that he has given his name as very security for his word, and he will not forget that. And so it explains his actions. It explains why God has come down to Egypt, why he's meeting with Moses face to face, as we learn in the book of Deuteronomy, and talks to him like a man might just call up his friend and go sit down and talk with him. That's the way that God was talking with Moses here. This isn't a vision. This isn't a dream. This isn't writing on the wall or in the sky. This is the Lord talking to Moses face to face. Again, making himself known and explaining why he is here, why he's doing what he's doing. He remembered his covenant with the fathers. He was not reacting. In other words, he didn't just look down upon Israel and, oh, I kind of forgot about them. What's going on with them? Oh, well, things look pretty bad. Maybe I should do something. Now, we might have those sort of reactions. In fact, we do. We sometimes just forget about things. And something triggers our mind to think about, oh, I better look into that, better check that, better see how things are going. Oh, something's wrong here, something's a problem, maybe I can do something to help. We have that kind of experience all the time, but that's not the case with God. He's not reacting just because, well, the suffering has gotten really bad. It was bad before, but now it's really bad, so maybe I'll do something about it. It's not special circumstances. No, he swore by his own name that he would do this, and that's why he is there. And this is what he wants Moses to tell the children of Israel. Not show them any great signs or wonders. Those are going to come. But he instructs Moses to tell Israel, God makes seven promises to them. Right here in this passage, seven promises. And you'll note them marked off every time by I will something. Seven promises that God makes. The descendants of Israel and Jacob, of course, that chosen, promised nation to Abraham. Number one, he says, I will bring them out of Egypt and out from under their burdens in Egypt. Number two, he says, I will snatch away or rescue them from bondage, from slavery. Number three, I will redeem them. I will act as a kinsman redeemer to ransom them, to set them free. And the language of a stretched out arm means that God is going to do so with a display of power. He's not going to just sort of quietly in the dark of night just sort of escort them away with a hush and stillness. No, it's going to be with a display of great power, he says, that he's going to redeem them. with a great number, a great, this great describing these judgments is great in magnitude as well as great in number that God is going to work with a stretched out arm. Number four says he will lay hold of and take them as his own people, his own nation. Number five, he says he will be their God, meaning they will know him. He will make himself known to them. He will act on their behalf. To be a God to them doesn't just mean to be an all-powerful celestial being that they recognize and serve, but that he provides for them, that he cares for them, that he has placed his own name on the line for them, and he will keep it. Number six, he will bring them to the land that was promised to their fathers, even though this was centuries and generations beforehand. He will keep this promise. Number seven, he will give them that land for an inheritance possession, just as was promised to their fathers. Seven promises that God makes to Israel in Egypt of what he will do. In verse number 9, and Moses spake so unto the children of Israel, but they hearkened not unto Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. So in all of this, God told Moses to go and tell this to the children of Israel. And of course, he sealed it all. I am the Lord. I am Yahweh. And Moses did. He gave that word to Israel. But because of the severity of their sufferings in slavery, essentially this verse tells us their spirits were broken. And they just wouldn't listen to Moses. And this word that's translated hearken here, it's the word for hearing that is so common in Proverbs. We've talked about it so many times. It means to listen deliberately with understanding, to pay attention and to take heed to what is spoken. And so the word implies an obedience in the hearing and the understanding. But Israel refused to heed the word of the Lord through Moses. Verses 10 to 13. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, go in, speak unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, that he let the children of Israel go out of his land. And Moses spake before the Lord, saying, behold, the children of Israel have not hearkened unto me. How then shall Pharaoh hear me, who am of uncircumcised lips? And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, and gave them a charge unto the children of Israel, and unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. So God here renews Moses' mission. Moses, nothing has changed. Nothing. Pharaoh's refusal, even to the point now that we see that Israel is not believing and obeying as they were initially. But nevertheless, nothing has changed. Your charge is still the same. And Moses raises an objection here. Israel wouldn't listen to me. They wouldn't believe. Why should Pharaoh? And if we think about some of the circumstance, surely Pharaoh would know some of the dissension within Israel, some of their disaffection from Moses and Aaron, and he had a hand in bringing that about. And so he's saying, why would Pharaoh be motivated? Pharaoh is going to be less motivated now to listen than what he was before. I mean, the great numbers of Israel, which has been a concern among the Pharaohs, he has sort of mitigated that risk, and so he's going to be less inclined to listen now. And then furthermore, he returns to this subject of just his general unfitness for this task, this uncircumcised lips, which basically means sinful and weak, but just overall is just unfit. And then, of course, there in verse 13, the Lord assured Moses, nothing has changed. You have a charge for Israel, you have a charge for Pharaoh, and you have to go and deliver those. Well, then we look at the rest of this chapter, which seems sort of like an odd interlude when you're just reading through this. Like, what, we have this genealogy and sort of a few commentary verses, and it seemed like we could have skipped right to the end and then went into chapter number 7. But really in this part of this chapter, we see God emphasizing that He is still God. So in verses 14 to 25, we have this genealogy list. Let's look at this. These be the heads of their fathers' houses. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanno and Palu, Hezron and Carmi. These be the families of Reuben. And the sons of Simeon, Yimuel and Yamin and Ohad and Yachin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of a Canaanitish woman. These are the families of Simeon. And these are the names of the sons of Levi, according to their generations, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And the years of the life of Levi were 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni and Shimi, according to their families. And the sons of Kohath, Amram and Itzar and Hebron and Uziel. And the years of the life of Kohath were 133 years. And the sons of Merari, Mahali and Mushi, these are the families of Levi according to their generations. And Amram took him Jochebed, his father's sister, to wife, and she bare him Aaron and Moses, and the years of the life of Amram were 137 years. And the sons of Itzar, Korah and Nepheg and Zichri, and the sons of Uziel, Mishael and Elzaphan and Zithri. And Aaron took him Elisheba, daughter of Amminadab, sister of Naashon's, to wife. And she bare him Nadab and Abihu and Eleazar and Ithamar. And the sons of Korah, Asir and Elkanah and Abisaph. These are the families of the Korahites. And Eleazar, Aaron's son, took him one of the daughters of Putiel to wife. And she bare him Phinehas. And these are the heads of the fathers of the Levites according to their families. So verses 14 to 25 again gives us sort of an odd interlude that just sort of seems to be inserted into this account. Now, we have encountered similar situations with genealogical lists and such in the book of Genesis we studied a while back. And we have seen that there's always a purpose with these genealogies. There's always a purpose that's served, not just in the preservation of the history of Israel, though it certainly does do that and it accomplishes that, but there's always a purpose that is served in the account in which the genealogy is recorded. And this list, when we look at it, it's a very partial genealogy. It traces Jacob and his first three sons, and that's it. So we have Reuben and Simeon and Levi. And really when you look at the genealogy, there's sort of this focus down the center. There's a focus on Levi and his descendants and tracing that lineage from Levi down to Aaron and even to his grandson Phinehas. Now the genealogy is certainly an important connection with the past, showing God's faithfulness to His promises. I mean, the fact that this genealogy even lists down to the grandson of Aaron is a testimony to the faithfulness of God in preserving this nation just as He had promised and prospering them. He's preserved Israel. He's made them into a great nation in Egypt, just like He promised. And we can also see here the preservation of those tribal lines of Israel. In other words, Israel developing from a family into a nation, into an alm, into a people or a people group. And we've talked about some of that development before as well. And tracing this to Aaron's grandson, Phinehas, shows this continuity. And it shows these connections with the future, just like the past. So this list, not only does it look back, but it also looks forward to the future of Israel, and that future is there because of what has happened in the past with God's promises to this people. And of course, in this list in particular, we get the family of Aaron and of Moses. And such genealogy, this list, will be important later for matters of inheritance as well as the priesthood that will be seen later in this book. So what is the purpose of this particular genealogy here in this account, in this chapter, again, as we sort of have this bridge between the first audience with Pharaoh and the next audience that is coming up? Well, verses 26 and 27 actually serve to give us that purpose. These are that Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, "Bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies." These are they which spake to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt, and these are that Moses and Aaron. Of course, this is being written down much later after they've already come out of Egypt. But this purpose of the genealogy really can be seen in these verses. It shows us who Moses and Aaron were as descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Who Moses and Aaron were as heirs of the covenant promises sworn to Abraham. They were chosen by God to bring Israel out in fulfillment of God's promises to the fathers. It highlights twice here we see how this is that Moses and Aaron of this genealogy. This is their lineage. This is who it was that God used to deliver Israel from Egypt. And so once again, demonstrating to us who God is and what it means for Him to remember. That means His faithfulness, His loyalty to His promises and the recipients of those promises. And then we look at the end of this chapter, verses 28 to 30. And it came to pass on the day when the Lord spake unto Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, I am the Lord. Speak thou unto Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say unto thee. And Moses said before the Lord, Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh hearken unto me? So we get in these verses sort of a recap. It's one of those sort of editorial comments that we get along in this historical narrative. And if you notice the verses right before this genealogy, verse number 13, then we get this genealogy, then we get this purpose of the genealogy explained, and then we get these verses 28 to 30. And so there's this recap that sort of puts a frame around this genealogy, which shows its importance and its placement. In other words, it's purposeful. It is here for that reason. But we encounter here once again this charge. It's reiterated. Go and tell Pharaoh that Yahweh, that Lord in all caps, Yahweh said, let Israel go. Now, Moses again brings this objection. And Moses, as we saw in chapters 3 and 4, as Moses raised a few objections, Moses hasn't yet in any way, he hasn't objected that God is unable to do this, or that God's unwilling to do this, or that this is just impossible to be done. His objections always center around his own limitations, his own weakness, his own unfitness for the task. And maybe in Moses' mind, he sees his first audience with Pharaoh as this particular failure. Moses perhaps is thinking, well, if maybe I was a better speaker, or I had better command, or what have you, maybe this wouldn't have happened this way. But nevertheless, he brings up these limitations again. His uncircumcised lips. Remember, it's comes back to Moses in chapter 4 when he finally says, God, just send somebody else. I cannot speak well. Just send somebody else. I'm not qualified. I'm not fit for this task. Well, if we've read and understood the account to this point, we know that Moses and Aaron actually did not fail in their first audience with Pharaoh. They were faithful to do what God had called them to do. And they certainly didn't fail because of any human limitations. No, they did what they were supposed to do. And though it may have looked like that they failed or that things went wrong. We know that that's only serving God's purpose and plan, because he's made known from the very beginning he's going to bring judgment on Egypt. So they're not going to just go quietly and let Israel go. And so again, we come at the end of this chapter and we get the re-emphasis of this crucial lesson. Nothing has changed. God hasn't changed. God's plan hasn't changed. Moses and Aaron are getting certain experiences. They're learning. Israel is going to learn. But God hasn't changed, and nothing has changed about his plans. Well, this chapter, chapter 6 here in Exodus, it gives us an important theological context to the earlier events and the fallout. And again, it seems like you're reading through the account and it seems like, well, this is just kind of stuck in here and what purpose does this serve? But really, it does help us to understand these historical events. But we've talked about before how that in the Bible, it's not just a recording of history for history's sake. But it is a telling of the acts of God. It is a record of God's acts in history. And so here in Egypt, God has from the very start made it known that he has a dual purpose that is going to be fulfilled through his actions, particularly in this section of chapters 5 to 15. What is that dual purpose? Well, that dual purpose is on the one hand to bring destruction on Egypt. And remember, he promised that all the way back in Genesis chapter 15. He promised that to Abraham. And that nation whom they will serve, he said, I will judge. He has a purpose to bring destruction on Egypt. And that purpose is not going to be hindered or thwarted. And the other purpose in the same actions is to save Israel. And we've already seen in the book of Exodus, as you start out, God seems to be silent. He seems to be absent. We even get that early language that we saw in some of the laments in the Psalms of, you know, God, why aren't you acting? Why aren't you hearing? Why aren't you responding? So God seems to be somewhat absent in the beginning. But God is actually very much at work. He's preserving Israel. He's prospering. He's growing them into a large nation, just like he promised to do. So he's already been at work, and he's also going to bring about the salvation, the redemption of Israel from Egypt. And he's going to do it. He's going to do all of this. He's going to accomplish this dual purpose. He's going to do all this in such a way that he will make himself known, both to his enemies and to his own people. And as we will see in the book of Exodus, he will do so in order that he be glorified in it all. Now, we've already seen Pharaoh has interpreted events in a certain way. And actually, the Pharaohs, we could say, have done so as they've had Israel in their midst and have seen their population growth that's extraordinary as it was. And they've interpreted events in a particular way. We've seen how that Israel is interpreting these events in a particular way, almost in the sense of the way that Jacob did before he even went into Egypt. All these things are against me, Jacob was brought to say at one point. And now Moses has interpreted events another way. God, I tried. I did what you told me to do. I tried, but I failed. And I don't have it. I just can't do this task. But God has shown us, particularly in this chapter, again, that true interpretation and the meaning of these events. Why? Because, plainly, he was the author of them all. Now, when we look at this chapter, we realize that we, as sinful human beings as we are, we're just as fickle as Pharaoh and as Israel. We are so easily upset when things don't turn out the way that we want, or the way that we like, or the way that we think they should. And we're oftentimes just so surprised when they seem to turn out in direct opposition. But God is unchanged. God is unchanged. No matter what men and women do, and regardless of what happens in this election coming up in a couple of months, God is unchanged, and His plan is unchanged. I'm sure that all of us are anxious about what's going to happen in November. How's this election going to go? And we all have in our mind ways we'd like to see it go, way we'd like to see things turn out. But what if it doesn't turn out that way? Is God somehow changed? Is God somehow been hindered? No, God is unchanged. His plan is unchanged. So really in this chapter, Moses and Aaron and Israel and even us today get a good dose of strong medicine. And it's something that so many of us just don't like and we reject. And that is this. God does everything that He does to His own purpose and will. And He's not moved off of that. He doesn't have plan Bs. You know, we like, especially if those of us that are planners, we like to have contingencies even. We want to plan, and then we want to plan for when that plan fails. We want to plan for that, and then we want to plan for this. God doesn't have plan Bs. God doesn't have contingencies. God has His plan, and it will be fulfilled perfectly and completely. God does everything that He does, first and foremost, for the sake of His own name and His own glory. And He's already making that known in Exodus, and it's going to be even more pronounced as you go through Exodus. God doesn't do things for our desires. God doesn't do things for needs that we assume that we have. He doesn't do things for or according to our wishes. If we pay attention, God is making Himself known in these pages. And we learn more about Him. And we'll also, right along with Moses, learn why God doing things the way He does is so good for us. Yeah, Moses learns that lesson, and we should too.